I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to Now Where Were We? Bob Cryer here with the second part of the chat that Dad and I had with the human tonic that is Danny Baker. This is part two, so if you want to listen to part one first, be my guest. But if you'd prefer to carry on and hear about Dad's time working with Eric and Ernie, let's press on.
Now, dear Duncan, bless him, he got really annoyed. I said, you've got to recognise what Eddie was brilliant. John and I wrote, I hope, some good stuff. And yeah. We went to ITV with Eric and Ernie when Eddie couldn't come initially. He was tied up at the BBC. And, you know, the received impression in the press was, oh, in decline. Eric and Ernie have left the BBC. But, you know, we did Jekyll and Hyde with Judi Dench and all sorts of stuff. And, it wasn't the great days of the Christmas shows.
Yeah.
But
I think they've been very much re-evaluated. I saw quite a few things recently saying, apart from the kind of way it was shot, they said, what's different? What's the difference here with the BBC, with the BBC stuff? Nothing.
It's the kind of affection that you have for the particular broadcast that sometimes affects the way
And also, the sentimentality of fortune and other cliches. You know, people don't want change. They don't want it. And so they'll be looking and say, what's different? And if it, by some chance, the first show wasn't funny, then that's how people remember it.
That's right.
They do not remember the highlights. I mean, that's to say that everything on the BBC was tip-top and always brilliant. It may not have been that either.
Eric said to Duncan and I one day, we got Vera Lynn coming on as a guest, and Eric said to me and John, I think it'd be funny if she doesn't know we wanted to sing. Which I thought, oh, boy. We thought, that is good. So we did it, and Vera was marvellous. She got it straight away. Very effusively, Ernie, Vera Lynn, enormous applause. What are you going to sing for us, Vera? Sorry? Now Ernie collapses. What? Oh, I didn't know you wanted me to sing. I thought I was just a guest. Cut to Eric as another camera. Come here, sunshine. Ernie comes over. What's going on? Ernie says, Vera doesn't know we want her to sing. How can we get her to sing? And Eric said, short of starting another war, I've no idea.
What a lie. Oh, my God.
That was junking.
Wasn't there a Falklands follow-up to that when he said, are we going to war? I don't know whether we're going to war, but I've just passed Vera Lynn's dressing room and heard her gargling.
Her gargling.
Doddy.
That's the thing.
Doddy. The word was gargling.
That's the thing.
Brilliant.
Gargling is the thing.
And Don Blatt also did a rather immaculate joke on the same theme. The Second World War was started by Vera Lynn's agent. So Vera loved it.
Yeah, of course.
She joined in.
Of course.
She was lovely.
You know, even though, you know, one of her dearest children singing We'll Meet Again over and over and over again, she probably was happy to send it up a little bit. But you mentioned, seen every other day on Twitter and stuff, they always put up the clip of Andre Previn, of course, you know, probably the apogee, the apex of what people remember the Morton Wise show for. But the supposition there is that Andre Previn was this long-haired director who threw himself into it with, you know, gusto. When in fact, not his main autobiography, but his subsequent autobiography, where he says, possibly because people said you were really funny on that with Wide Eyes, he said, I don't think you know a lot about me. And he wrote about his early career when he was just a jobbing arranger at MGM and used to, at 15, he would get three buses and a train to the studios and sit there, and he had just a brain for arranging things. They give him B films to work out and do the scales for this. And he said, probably my most famous piece of work, people have heard over and over again, that nobody realises it's me. He said, you know, in Tom and Jerry cartoons, whenever Jerry jumps to the top of some curtains and then falls all the way down, clawing, holds it, the piano does a glissando. That's me. He said, that's what I'd do. I would sit there and if it was Zorro, I would pound out these sounds. He said, I was like a silent music. And he tells, what's the, oh, if I only remember who it was, Jack Lemmon. And he tells this story here, involves curse words. And he says, because he knew them all, and they all knew him as a wonder kid who was very funny and wrote these incredible scores. And one day he'd be on, Buck Wilco Rides Again and Cactus Serenade, and then he'd be on a Ben Hur film in the afternoon. And that's what he did, you know. So he wasn't this classical conductor.
No, he knew.
So he knew all that. But he tells his story, and he says his great friend was Jack Lemmon. He's the funniest man I ever met. He said, because his way of describing stuff, it's a great story in the book. And a friend of theirs, a woman friend of theirs, gets married. And Jack Lemmon's great friend was Ernie Kovacs, the great innovative. Yeah, the great Ernie Kovacs. And Ernie says, who's the guy she's married? And he says his name. He goes, what's he like? Yeah, he says, he's a good guy. He went, yeah. And he says, well, what do you mean? He went, Ernie... There were a barbecue in the garden. Ernie, if I'd have turned up here today wearing a red baseball cap and walked around the grounds, what would you have said? Nothing. He said, if you'd have turned up here today wearing a red baseball cap and walked around the grounds, I said, hey, he said, this guy turns up with her wearing a red baseball cap. You would nudge me and say, who's the prick in the red baseball cap? He said, that. He said, that's the guy. That's the kind of guy he is. And I was, what a beautifully convoluted way of saying that. He said, you just don't like him the moment you see him.
Yes, but he had a background. His dad had done film. Yeah. He knew jazz and everything. He wasn't some orchestral...
No, but that's the way... That, but obviously, for the purposes of the bit, he had to be.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's funny that people say he really got it. I'm sure he thought, at last.
But he did... I don't know whether he says it in the book. He said, Eric Morecambe said to me, because he only read it in the taxi coming from the airport.
Yes, that's right. He'd come literally off a plane.
Eric Morecambe said to me, you and me and Ernie are the only ones who don't find this funny.
Yeah.
And he did it perfect.
Oh.
And you can see the orchestra loving
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was written originally by Sid Green and Dick Hills for
ITV. Is it one of theirs?
With Ernie playing the conductor and a small group.
Oh.
So when they replay when they do the radio episodes every now and again of Morecambe and Wise, I heard it in that version.
Well, there was a tremendous thread on one of the comic writers' sites recently about the joke, you won't sell many ice creams going at that speed.
Yeah.
And they traced that back and back and back and back, you know, which of course that is the perfect realisation of it, but it didn't come out of nowhere.
No.
There's been quite a few versions of
it. A few incarnations of that.
Exactly.
Before it,
and I find that absolutely... I don't think it diminishes it one bit.
The brilliant
thing.
Well,
you always say, you don't. You know, jokes don't necessarily...
No.
They're not necessarily written, they evolve.
And also, when you first get started, thank God for it, because when I first got started, nobody was watching old Ritz Brothers films. And I would deliver this bit, and they would say, that's so funny. I'll say, yes, it is, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
You are born out of time, aren't you?
No,
feel like you...
Here's the a phrase I'd... Probably if somebody said, what is your least favourite phrase?
Have I just used it?
No. It's not in part, but it's when people say that. I've read W.C. Fields. He was so ahead of his time.
Oh, I see.
What do you mean? He was paid hundreds of thousands of pounds to make film that made big profits in the 30s and 40s. We're not smarter now than they were then.
Exactly.
What do you mean? But so only now we're getting this stuff. Believe me, no, people at W.C. Fields were big in the 30s and 40s, as were the Marx Brothers, because they were absolutely of their time.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely of
but
their time.
But I'm talking about you specifically.
No,
you seem to gravitate to... stuff of the 30s
you've
and 40s.
Got it, or you haven't, when you sit and watch telly, either you like the horror things or you like the mysteries or you like the science fiction, anything that had audience laughter in it. My mum and dad bringing back the Hancock albums, the first time I ever heard them, not on the radio, the Goons and everything, on LP. The Max Miller 10-inch Max at the Met was the first thing I ever had. And when I did the first tour... The second half used to begin with the second half of that LP with his play on music, Mary from the Dairy. And the audience applauded him. And I would then, for the next 30 seconds, mouth sync with what he said. And the audience thought, what's he doing? Don't take a lot to bring me back. No, there's one there, they've got opera glass. And I would do it perfectly and then stop and say, I've not gone nuts. That's how well I know the LP from the age of six.
Midday musical, what it says on the tin, a live radio show. And I was bottom of the bill. I was in Musical Espresso Bongo, but that's not
the
internet. Playhouse Theatre, radio show, Max Miller, top of the bill. I thought, oh, boy, I'm going to meet Max Miller. They'd opened the dressing rooms. I thought, for radio? And he wore the full stage costume for radio, the white hat and the plus fours and everything.
Blue book,
can't work in ordinary clothes, son. Can't work in ordinary clothes. So we do the run-through, blah-de-blah-de-blah. Bill Worsley, the producer, I remember. And Max has got something scribbled on a bit of paper. So he suddenly goes, bus breaks down. Driver says the conductor, start ring the garage, I'll fix this. Gets his head under the bonnet, he's fixing it. 10 minutes go by, the passenger's getting restless. Conductor goes down, says to him, do you want a screwdriver? He said, no, we're 10 minutes late already. Now then. Bill Worse has got his head in his hands. He says, you're not going to tell that, Max, are you? Am I? I don't know. So we go to a pub called the Sherlock Holmes, close by. Ray Ellington and the quartet are there. And Ray came over. And it may have even been a fiver. And Max said, well, he said, I bet you don't tell that joke today. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So Max opened his wallet and we all sort of moth flew out, you know. And we all game on. There's a bet on now. And we did the live radio show. And he never told that joke at all.
He just did it.
He went off. He never told it. We go back to the pub and Ray Ellington said, pay up, Max. What are you talking about? You never told that joke. I was going to. They flashed that bloody light at me.
Oh, split it down the middle. Oh, well, I used to listen to that Max at the Met. And, of course, in those days, even when I'm like a kid, those films, I mentioned the Ritz Brothers and things, used to be on telly all the time.
That's right.
And I didn't differentiate because everyone's in black and white.
I remember Tuesday Nights was Harold Lloyd.
Harold Lloyd, exactly. Bob Mungest doing the Golden Greats and all
that's
of that.
That's right, yeah.
But everyone was in black and white, so I didn't differentiate between them. But I don't think I was alone in that. But that, I'd never understood the jokes, but I just knew that noise that come at the end when he tells that, he says, a little boy is always biting his nails. And his mum said, you don't want to bite your nails? Your knife get fat if you bite your nails. And he says, I won't bite them anymore then. So he went out and saw a fellow and he was going about 20 stone. And he said, mum, well, I'll get like that if I bite my nails. You get worse than that if you bite your nails. This is literally word for word. They took him shopping. She got on another bus and there's a blonde sitting there. She was carrying a bit of weight as well. So he looked across and the kiddie looked at the blonde and the blonde looked at the kiddie. And she said to him, do you know me? He said, no, but I know what you've been doing. Anyway,
brilliant.
I had no idea what that joke would mean.
Yeah, brilliant.
But I knew everyone
but you
went,
knew the rhythm of it.
And I just, and that literally was the rhythm of it. That's word
for
word.
I
know what you've been doing. Massive laugh. Anyway, and I just thought,
the rhythm.
But an important bit being...
Somebody else could tell that journey.
Mike Berry, veteran music.
Yeah.
Turned up in my pub one day. Oh, boy, it was great. And invited
not literally your
Dave,
pub,
your
but
brother,
it's...
to a gig they were doing that very night. And I went over to the gig and it was just great. But nobody on the stage was under 70.
Yeah.
And I said to Mike afterwards, I said, if I closed my eyes, I'd have had no idea. It sounded great, all the stuff. And, you know, he was lovely. He said, you know what it is, Baz? He said, it's like you telling jokes. It's called rhythm. I thought,
hello.
Sorry quoting that, but there we are.
Absolutely.
No, it is when you get somebody telling a joke who overdoes it.
Yeah.
This Scotsman went into a pub and said, hey, Jimmy, I said, I think, get on with it.
And not only that, as someone who fitted, I might include myself in that company, if you're involved in it and write it, your first thought as soon as they start a joke is, okay, I've got this, I know where this is going. And you try to anticipate it. But you know, and I saw the discussion about this among comedians the other week on Twitter. And you first told me this joke, the head is half an orange joke.
Oh, yes.
And everyone said, but that is the pros joke.
That's
head,
for us.
That is totally that. And now, of course, when people said, what is it? And you try and tell them, but that is the perfect thing. You think, okay, I know where this joke is going. And of course, you don't.
Colin Sell, my mate at the piano, I've known him for years. I'll never forgive him. One night, we were doing the gig and he said to me, tell him half his head was an orange. And I said, I got what he was up to. I said, no, Colin, you tell it much better than me.
Well, coming all full circle to Tommy Cooper again, the great joke there, which used to get a big laugh, but probably more from a game, people in the game, was he knocks on Harry's door and his wife answers the door in black, all distraught. Who's Arian? No, he died 2 days. What? He died 2 days ago, didn't you? No, I didn't hear anything. Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, my God, it's awful. We're planning a funeral. Oh, it's awful. Oh. He didn't say anything about a tin of paint, did he? That joke, you cannot see where that is going to go.
Why has it got to be a tin of paint?
A tin of paint.
That's perfect.
That's yes. it. Yes. Sausages, no. You know,
Here we go. It's like the parrot joke.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I collect them.
There's a few.
You know this.
Just a bit, go on.
It's the definitive. A woman sees this beautiful blue and gold parrot in the shop, and she says to the man, he's gorgeous. How much? He said, 20 quid, 20 pounds. She said, he's beautiful. He said, well, yeah, I'm sorry, but he's got form. He's got history. He was in a brothel. And to put it delicately, he's got quite a colourful vocabulary. Oh, I'll take it that. Took the parrot back to a flat, took the cover off, and the parrot looked round and said, new place, very nice. And the two daughters walked in, and the parrot said, new place, new girls, very nice indeed. And her husband walked in, and the parrot said, hello, Keith. And it's got to be Keith.
Keith, yeah, absolutely.
We overheard a man telling that joke in the pub, me and some mates, and we were leaning in and listening.
And he
said, and the parrot said, hello, Brian. No,
Keith.
Hello, Keith. One syllable. Keith.
Keith has to be there.
A great example of that, you're talking about the economy, and you usually look for the quickest route to the punchline, you personally. Yeah. Doesn't always affect every comedian that way. I showed Dad some Norm MacDonald stuff on YouTube.
I love it.
Yeah.
To the point that it was an interesting exercise because Norm tells a moth joke that Dad will now tell if the money's right. But he spins it out to this Chekhovian drama.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
My son Ivan Ilyich, you know, he sort of doesn't love me and all of this kind of stuff. But your version of the joke is...
Wait, which moth joke is this? Yes.
These two moths walk into a bar.
Yeah.
Anyway,
well, no, it's similar to that because you said the greatest opener to a joke that you might tell in a minute is Graham Garden's one about the ventriloquist in the outback.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I don't know this.
That's to come, but this
in
one is
this carnation.
This moth walks into a chiropodist, as it is in your version.
Oh,
but it's
yes,
a podiatrist in Norm MacDonald's version.
Moth, yes. And the chiropodist said, what can I do for you? And he said, my wife's left me. He said, my son's on drugs. This is the moth speaking. My daughter's on the game. I'm in despair. I don't know what to do. And the chiropodist said, you should see a psychiatrist. Why did you come to see me? And the moth said, the light was on.
Again, I was thinking...
Look what happens
sprung off. But I was thinking that, okay, you're going to be something to do with the light here. It's going to be that way. You can't help it.
But Norm MacDonald, it's 5 minutes.
Norm MacDonald, that idea that he's a fellow who's walked out on stage just to fill a few moments before a real comedian comes on. That's it. You know, I'm not a big history buff. I don't know. I'm not a... But, you know, I look, this First World War, and Germany went to war with the world. They went to war with the world. And then 20 years later, they go to war again with the world. What? The German, you know, what's it next? Mars? He said, why do they keep going to war? And of course, he does this idea as if he's just, at this moment, this is occurring to him. Which is,
the persona is important.
I think that's brilliant. I love that. Yeah. It's not what I do, but he.
Yeah.
The sort of Shaggy Dog story, narrative. It's brilliant.
The very best was Mitch Hedberg for me. And Mitch Hedberg died when he was... I think he's 30.
Yeah.
He used to do this act where he appeared half stoned, but with Stephen Wright type of observations. Mitch Hedberg is one of those people now that any kind of obscure joke gets attached to, but he doesn't need it because his act was that.
Danny remembers what we were talking about earlier today when we were coming in. There's an American called Foster Brook.
Great drunk.
He played drunk and he didn't drink at all, but he played. But somebody over here nicked the act and did it
as
well.
Yes, they did.
And we couldn't remember the name.
Oh, yes, they did.
The British Foster Brooks, basically.
Yes, they did. I don't know. But then again,
He was brilliant.
Then again, you could say Foster Brooks nicked it from Freddie Frinton, who did a very good drunk, very good drunk Freddie Frinton.
Foster Brooks' thing was always the burp.
All of us have tried to do that.
Yeah.
You know, you can't do it.
Right. No.
And Dean Martin and all them just wanting to do that.
Doing his TV, massive TV show.
Walking into the bar on
those
apple juice. Playing
it drunk.
Of course. You cannot do that. You cannot do that.
Well, you mentioned Michael Aspel earlier. The rumour was that...
He had gin in his water glass or something.
What's his name? You know, a barnstorming actor of the 70s and 80s, British actor, who was on Aspel's show drunk.
Oliver Reed.
Oliver Reed comes in with the
Oliver Reed,
the carafe of orange juice.
I was in LWC that night.
Yeah.
I was there that night. Oliver Reed famously turned up drunk on Aspel's set and it's become notorious. The story I heard, and I think it bears more fruit than that, Oliver Reed may have become a cartoon drunk. At that time, he weren't. He was on there to promote it. He went there with his brother. This is exactly as I heard it at the time, and I was working at the studios. He went there with his brother, and anyone who's, again, sorry to be exclusive here, has ever been, you know, it's worse these days, but you're shown to a dressing room at LWT, and for the next half an hour, all you get is... Okay, and you open the door. Hi, wardrobe, which is fine, you know. Hi, do you need anything? Hi, could you go to my company in 10 minutes? It's relentless. If you're trying to read a book, it's murder. I'll tell you a Spike Milligan story after this. So Oliver Reed, they'd obviously been told, keep him away from booze. And he had got there with his brother and he said, can we send down a couple of beers? Can somebody get us a couple of... we can't really do that. Are you okay? And he sensed this kind of... Anyway, they kept knocking every 2 minutes. Hi, Oliver, we're going to be a few minutes yet, and we're going to take you through. He said, can we get a couple of beers? And they said, we really don't want you. Anyway, he went to the pub across the road, came back, was refreshed, not pissed, but he came back, and he just sensed this relentless, how you doing, Oliver? And they're looking into his eyes, and he thought, they want drunk, I'll give them drunk. And
yes.
if you watch it, he's got his shirt hanging out.
Yeah.
He's got this jug of apparently vodka and orange. He's acting like a ham drunk.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you look at the interview, at one point Aspel says to him, I'm going to have to say this, why do you appear like this in public? And he says, because, Michael, I have no wish to live in a world of mundane sobriety. That's not a drunk's answer.
But it was like
not a drunk's answer.
It's like a cry for help.
Yeah.
Because I was with him, I don't know if it's the same show, and I met Ollie in the Crete, Ollie, he says, in the green room. He was cold sober.
Yeah.
We chatted. And then they said, come on, you two, go down to the studio. And he was really, he was whispering and talking to me. And then they signaled it's time for him to go on. And he went on.
And did the whole thing.
And he went into the act. And he punched a hole in the polystyrene scenery.
I think there's the same
Henry
one.
Cooper was sitting with...
I think it is.
Yeah.
Henry Cooper was sitting with Wendy Richard, I think. And Ollie said, "Hello, Henry, my old mate," and took a swing at Henry Cooper. And the audience are going, my God, what's going on? Henry Cooper said to me afterwards, he said, it was totally professional.
He missed the film, but just missed it.
Yeah.
Dear Wendy Richard, she said, my eyelashes fell off. I thought, what is happening? He played it drunk.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interview.
Well, that's why.
And I thought, do I tell everybody? And I did.
Because
I
said, he'd been wound up.
Because he'd been wound up. And plainly, while,
he
was getting his introduction, he must have pulled his shirt out.
Yes.
Because nobody would let him go on the set. They would let him go on the set like that.
He was cold sober in the green room before.
Always
what is this ambivalent thing they do?
Well, because it's like, I tell you, in all my time spent with Gazza,
Yeah.
He found it much more expedient and less stressed to give a 2-minute performance of him with a comedy boob.
This
and
is what they expect.
And he wasn't like that. Paul wasn't like that. Paul didn't drink. I've told this many times. Paul didn't drink, which he later learned to and became very morose and lonely after he was. But Paul, the first time I met him, he loved the fact that I don't mind a drink. And I was sitting with him. We got on great from the moment we met. But you'd sit in a pub with Paul and there'd be other people around, footballers. Not quite, if you might say, of his cerebral genius, which he is. He is, the thing with Paul Gascoigne here was cosmically bored, always.
Yes.
Football was never his thing.
They've got to break the boredom, haven't they?
First time I went to his house, I went to his trophy room, which he had in his house. And it was, you know, not big, but still shelved from top to bottom. Every kind of trophy you can imagine, not just football, darts and snooker and tennis, anything. He was just like Rain Man. Sport was no problem to him. Again, I've said this a few times, but Barry might not know this. When he played snooker with the England fellas, he could only, they would only let him play against them if he held the cue in one hand. He wasn't allowed to, because he could beat them. When he played darts, he had to have the point of the dart point into his nose as he threw it. Otherwise, there was no game. When he played table tennis, nope, just his hands he could use, because he would beat you.
Yeah.
I played penalties with him on Newcastle's pitch for a film we were doing. We'll play penalties, Dan. You can hit it any way you like when I'm in goal, but I have to run backwards and at the last minute back heel it. Otherwise, he felt there was no...
So yes.
And consequently, when he was out, and with footballers boozing as they did in them days, he felt needed to keep up with this. And he would have usually a half a lager and a short. But he was one of them fellas, and I think we've all met him, who want to be like part of the lads.
Yeah.
But he'd put his drink under the table and pour a little bit away and then bring it back up. And
as if.
The floor around Paul would always be wet because he wanted to eat whatever the machismo involved.
So in many respects, the dentist chair celebration at Euro 96
sort of thing,
is an element of him saying...
You've got to be pretty smart to do that. He used to, but when you used to, I used to see him on bus stops with the fake boobs doing the tongue out thing. Yeah. He thought he wanted to be liked always. He's still to this day.
There's Gazza and there's Paul Gaskell.
The only
person I ever saw
stop traffic ever. Yeah. Stop traffic with Paul Gaskell. I walked through Piccadilly with him once, everything stopped. But he would think, he would, like a comedian, would see the one fella who was going, I couldn't care less, and think that's the real opinion of them.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Here's the thing. When he was with me and Chris Evans,
yes,
he found two good friends. We used to have a great time. But the fact we were very much of a piece in the way we lived, we didn't go to the Groucho Club and take cocaine. You know, God love it. I know plenty of people who did. We used to go to pubs like this. So we were very visible. And it became that sort of thing. They're boozing again. These 36-hour benders we were all supposed to go on.
Yes.
I had two kids in them days. My wife is a crack shot. I couldn't have gone on a 30...
can't stay awake for 36
exactly.
hours.
Exactly. But, I mean, Chris, by the way, Chris could do that. But Paul used to stay around my house always.
Yeah.
But if they saw us coming out...
It takes one photograph,
We know that. I don't even know, need to underline it. That's how that works. But Paul never understood that. And footballers will show him the headlines. And he always used to think he was a bad person who had lucked out. And once he lost contact with us, because he was told at his first 12,
yes,
don't get in touch with your old friends. We used to look after him. And also, he's one of the funniest men I ever met. But then the mental facility started falling away. He used to live in a hotel out towards Heathrow when he was playing at Tottenham.
Oh.
He lived in this hotel. A few times I went over to meet him, he'd be sitting in the bar, nursing half a lager with the most boring travelling salesman you ever met in your life. They were his friends, his company.
Yeah.
He didn't know anyone down here.
Yes.
And then we used to go out, but people would see us sitting with a drink in front of us, laughing our heads off. Photos, photos, photos. Gazza, drunk. Gazza, done this. Gazza, getting a late night kebab. Yes, he did get a late night kebab. I wasn't there that night. It was over by Chris's house. That time he was a front page of the paper because he was playing for England the next day. It might have been that. That's why that celebration he does.
Yeah.
The thing is with him, then, which the censorious sporting media and everyone else couldn't take, he could have a kebab and a bit of a skinful the night before and still go out and do that, as Jimmy Greaves used to be able
in
a different era.
Well, Terry Venables said that when Jimmy used to drive him to games, didn't he? And they'd stop off for a full mixed grill.
I understand that is not the way forward and that can't be done. But Paul used to, he's got a skin too few.
Yeah.
And I used to say, mate, but he used to feel it and believe the worst about him and never the best. Always the worst about him. And But whatever he did, he happened to become a footballer and one of the best. And when he was dropped by Glenn Hoddle at that World Cup thing, it destroyed him more than any drink he ever took in his life. But he was just, as we all know, you wouldn't have had him as one. I've met a lot of people. He was just the funniest, the greatest company. Yeah. Just dynamite, but man alive. A lot of people go through their lives. Everyone's got one friend like that.
Yeah.
He was mine. And he was a great, great friend. On stage, when I tell stories and when me and Linnick used to do it, did one of you told the other week when he was at Middlesbrough, and Middlesbrough bought a new coach, and I think it cost £400,000 because football clubs will pay £400,000, something like that.
Yeah.
And not a coach, I don't mean a coach in terms of, I mean an actual physical team coach.
Yeah.
And there was this big thing with the press and everyone was going to come as Middlesbrough stood by the new coach and probably paid half the fee back by doing the promotional photo. So Gazza thought, I know what I'll do. I'll nick it. I'll give the driver, just to drive it two streets away. So when everyone comes out, where's the coach? This is what he really did. So he goes up to the driver, Gazza, how are you? So he gives him, I don't know, £300 or something. Mate, I just want to drive it around the corner. Oh, poor guy. Come on, mate. It's all right. You know, I've got my HGV license. He hadn't. Of course, he goes up to the corner of the road in trying to take the... Hits a concrete bollard. Wallop. And decided his coach. So he then has to go back and say, I don't know what I was doing. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't know what I was doing. Now, he calls me up and said, Danny, I've just run a coach into a concrete bar. I said, what'd you do that for? Because it was going to be the showpiece and we're all outside and I just thought I'd park it a few streets. I said, now, it's a terrible...
When you start unpicking the plan.
I would say, Paul, what do you... I know. Now, of course, they took it out of debt and fines and all of that. But anyone who would do things like that, as well as when he was in China, let's not forget Paul went out to China.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah.
And he's out there and he would get in touch and say, they cut your hair on the street. There are fellas on the street that cut your hair. It's fucking mad. Because he won in Beijing, he was out in the sticks playing with this club that promised money he never got. He said, you can get weighed. People stand around to weigh you on the streets. He was full of it. Anyway, there was a little zoo near where he lived, a little zoo, right, a private zoo. He said he used to go down to that, and one morning he was watching a fella feed horses' heads to tigers, right? And now you got to realize, Paul is not telling this like we would, he tells you, and the followers there, I wish I could do a Geordie accent, and these horses' heads, they're just telling these horses' heads, and they throw their fucking tails. He made himself think, if I give you this much money, can I give a tiger a horse's head? So the fella, he says, I've got this fucking horse's head. He said, it's fucking slippery. It's just a horse's head like the Godfather. He said, and I've gone up to the tigers in bars, and I've gone up to the bars and it's gone around. I've gone, away. He won't let it have the horse's head, right? I'll let you have it. He's going to throw it over in a minute. He's teasing the tigers with his horse's head. He said, and then I thought I was going to just hoy it in there. He said, and I've got it by years. And I've gone like this, and it slipped out of the fingers and it went into the penguin pool, right? Now, as a story of a footballer in China, in a private zoo, pays someone to let him feed horses' heads to tigers. And you just think, when you see these banal stories about him. He also asked Jimmy to go out, and Jimmy was his Jeeves to his Bertie Wooster. And Jimmy ate snakes, so he paid this zoo, and this is true, to give him a snake, right? They turned up, and the handlers with him, and Jimmy turned up with a house across the road he hired, and he fed the snake through the letterbox of this place and then rang Jimmy and said, I'm outside. He said, I heard Jimmy from down the west here, as he was going, I just think this is not normal, but wow. He fed a snake through a letterbox.
You see these lads being interviewed with their bathroom bags and the mineral water and going,
oh, yeah.
So what's your day been like? Well, I chucked a horse's head into the penguin enclosure.
And I'm sure people now would, well, he needs help and all of this. But I don't know. I don't think Paul knows how great he is, how funny he is, how bizarre a life, how wonderful a life he's had.
And yes, how loved he is. That comes across.
That is the key to it all. He really, and so many people in comedy don't know how loved they are. They don't know how terrific they are.
Yeah.
And we've all sat with them, How do you think it went? I thought, I didn't think that went so well.
I mean, your wild man image, you've kept, under wraps for many a year. Kicking off again?
The purple people eater years.
Number one in Finland, excuse me.
Of course it was. Don't get me wrong.
Have respect.
Can I ask you, and I know we're running obscenely long, but how did you end up as... How did that happen?
Because Sheb Woolley, country singer and an actor... Yeah. He's one of the baddies who was going to kill Gary Cooper in High Noon.
Yes.
But he had this big hit, The Purple People Eater, sort of E.T.
Yes.
and it was issued here and sort of a hit.
Yeah.
But contractually or something happened, it wasn't issued in Scandinavia.
It's the only territory you didn't have.
Oh.
And I'd done a little English cover version. It was pushed out and it was number one in Finland. I said they gave away a car with each record.
The thing I never get is, how was it you doing it? Did you have ambitions to be a pop singer? Did your agent at the time saying, here's something?
Well, my mentor, Frankie Vaughan, bless him.
Stockport Town.
Originally from
isn't it
Liverpool,
obvious?
Liverpool.
Yeah.
But Frank and I finally got it together as friendship in London. And his manager and agent was Paul Cave. I was taken on board.
Oh.
At Chancery Lane in the office. And, this is where I spoke to Marilyn Monroe.
Do you know, once you said Frankie Vaughan, I was just about to say, there's a tale. There's a man, yeah, rather like Norman Wisdom and a few others, and Dinah Dawes, who went to Hollywood and said, no thanks.
Yes, Frankie that's Vaughan, right. Certainly. Yeah. There were several offices there, and I was out of work. I was taken on board, thanks to Frank, by the agency, and I was making the tea and answering the phone. And I was alone in this particular office, and Frank had done Let's Make Love, I think, a film with Marilyn Monroe.
Yes, he had, yeah.
And Yves Montand, whatever. And they were going to do a phone link up with America. God knows what time it was in America. This is much later in the day here. I don't know. Anyway, the phone rings, and I pick it up, and a voice says, is that the Paul Cave office? I said, yes, I have Miss Monroe for you. I'm looking around. There's nobody there in the office except me. Hello? And she sort of realised she was talking to a harmless young man, I think, not a journalist or anything. We chatted for about 2 or 3 minutes before anybody came in the office. And I'm pointing at the phone going, Marilyn Monroe!
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Again, this is a 9-hour show anyway. Dick Clement and Ian Frenay, whom God preserve.
Oh, yes.
They said when they were writing Elfrieda's Own Pet, they were writing it in Los Angeles because they were based in Los Angeles for quite a while, weren't they?
Yes,
they were writing Elfrieda's Own Pet. But they said they had local sources from up on Wearside and Tyneside who they would call to say, would this happen, would that happen? But because of the time difference, he said, we had to say, you know, we'll call you at this time. It's midday in Los Angeles, but it was 1 o'clock in the morning here.
Yes.
He said, and the fella said, and he was known to the police. He was known to them. But they needed for the storyline, they needed his input. And they said, right. And he said, well, look, there's a phone box outside our flats. He said, I'll be there at 1 o'clock. Call us. And they said, we will. He said, and he was standing by this phone box at 10 to 1 in the morning. And a panda car goes by and comes back the other way. And the police get out and they said, hello, Frankie. And he said, hey, lads, what are you doing? He said, I'm waiting for a call. And I said, who from? He said, from Hollywood. Get in. Yeah. It's from two fellas in Hollywood. Like, and get in, you go.
Michael Caine's story I heard recently. I think he'd written about it before. In the days long before the phone and everything, mobile, if you want to make a call when you're out and about, you had to go to a phone box.
Yeah.
And he was Maurice Micklewhite. That was his name.
Yeah, Michael Caine.
His agent said, God, we've got to do something about your name, you know, Michael this, Mark, whatever. And he said, he was in Leicester Square, and there are two cinemas in Leicester Square, and he saw this cinema poster, The Caine Mutiny. So he rang his agent and he said, I've had a strange idea. What do you think? Michael Caine. And his agent said, oh, I like it. I think we'll go with that. And Michael Caine told the story. He said, thank goodness I wasn't looking at the other cinema. I'd have been Michael 101 Dalmatians.
Well, we started, I'm only doing this if I'm carrying on as long as you like, with some of the more extraordinary strokes of dumb luck I've ever had. I mean, as I said about what I said to Kenneth Williams, which got me in there, and Mel Brooks. There are others along the way, which I always think, up until recent events, you had a Guardian star. How about this? I wrote the series Cradle to Grave, my great friend Jeff Pope, who I've known forever. And he rang me up and said, next Tuesday, what you doing? Nothing. Do you want to come and see an evening with Michael Caine at the Albert Hall? So we'll all go out, we'll stay in a good, you know, kind of live in London, you know. But he said, our wives are great friends. He said, Wendy and Tina take them, we'll stay in a good hotel, we'll have a nice lunch, we'll go to the Albert Hall. Oh, sounds good, yeah, we'll do that. Although secretly I was thinking, I don't know, I want to do it next Tuesday. Anyway, along we went. We went to the hotel, we checked in the hotel, lovely bar in the hotel, and I don't want to sound cavalier, but Jeff had said anyway, you know, he said, they're not great tickets, but we'll go and see this. Now, football supporters will recognise this. Sometimes you get into a little session, you think, do we really want to go and see the game? Do we really go and see? So I said, what time is it now? 7:10. What time's he on? 8:00. We'll have one more, yeah, and we'll see how we feel, all of this. So we decided we were having such a nice time and maybe we won't go. Anyway, 7:40, out we go, and it was a walk to the Albert Hall. As he's walking to the Albert Hall, he runs into someone else in the games. Hello, Jeff. You go into, oh, yes, we're going to there. Where are you sitting? And we showed them the seats. They weren't great seats. They was all right. We got them in the last minute. I can help you there. And they gave us two better seats. They were on, you know, in the nice circle. Oh, thank you so much. No, we weren't going to use them, you know. We got closer to the Albert Hall, and Jeff runs into someone, says, how do you have so-and-so, where are you sitting? Oh, come and sit with us. So, promise you this happened. They gave us even better seats. I said, this is nuts. This is nuts. Now we're on the floor of the place. Then we run into Steve Coogan, who Jeff writes with all the time. Oh, where are you? He said, no, do you want to be in a box? Now, this is the third time on this journey we've changed. I said, this is crazy. I said, we're not going to come now. We're in a box. He said, yeah. So he gives us these seats. We get in the Albert Hall and someone tells us he's not on for another 20 minutes. So we have another drink. And then we find our way to a box in the Albert Hall where I once showed my arse. That's another story for another. Oh, no, I should have told that. So anyway, in we go to this box and a lovely box in the Albert Hall, right overlooking the stage. And when you sit there and Jeff goes and sits there, I make my way along the row and I sit down and I'm sitting next to Michael Caine. Michael Caine is sitting next to me. And I said, hello. And he's got his programme up hiding his face. He said, this is the opening thing. We've got to film this. And Steve Coogan's behind me and he said that we're doing this thing at the beginning where him and Rob Brydon are having a conversation. This is the opening of the video they're making, saying, no, he does it like this. You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors up. And then Steve, no, he does it more like that. And he was then going to bring down his thing and say, this is how it works. And the audience go mad.
Right.
And then we cut. So from not wanting to go very much, not saying ever have a drink, getting better seats and better seats and better seats, I sit next to Michael Caine. If you ever, it's on YouTube. Have a look at the video.
You're there.
If you ever look at the video, the moment he drops his thing, there's me sitting next to him. And of course, I come from two streets away from him. We couldn't have got on better. And I did even say to Wendin, this is not normal. The fact that we come to see Michael Caine, I'm sitting next to him.
But so you showed your arse at the Albert Hall.
Very quickly. We were doing a thing, one of Elton John's tennis evenings. He used to do charity tennis nights where he invited tennis pros and famous people to play tennis at the Albert Hall, as it was. Again, back to the old 6 o'clock show. We were covering it, and it was a black tie thing. And they said, it'd be nice if you do the black tie and all of this. So I turned up for the thing. We're filming around the Albert Hall, doing the early part of it. But the live part of it is coming when Michael Aspel says, so Danny, you're there. How is it this evening? Who have you got with you? I was going to talk to somebody else out of this. So there's nowhere to get changed. And we're in the corridors of the Albert Hall. And I know what camera crews are like. This was in the days when television companies used to do their TV outtakes at Christmas, all the stuff, you know, yes, they were famous. Yeah. Every TV company did them. So I said, I'm not getting changed in front of you, you bastards. I says, no. I go into this, I get changed in one of the boxes. The audience are just arriving, I thought. I go into this box, and if you go into the box of the airball, there's a curtain, velvet curtain, and then the seats are beyond it. And I thought, I'm going to keep an eye on that door. They're going to burst through here and try and get shots of me, pantsless, trouserless. So I keep my eye on the door, and I take my jeans off and hold in my dinner suit, and I put my dinner suit on. Now my arse is through the curtain behind me, and I hear just a smattering of applause. And I thought, oh, no, the crew are there outside in the corridor. I am now showing my arse to the Albert Hall. And I jumped up and I put my head through it, and it was all right, it was only about a third fall. But yeah. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is how I showed my arse to the Albert Hall.
I cannot match that.
I think that'll do us.
Danny Baker, thank you for joining us.
This
thinly veiled excuse for Dad meeting old mates, basically.
Well, man alive, and God bless it. The whole
thing. I just wish we could have got Dan to tell some stories.
And with that, our time with Danny Baker is sadly over. But did he and Dad then stay in the pub talking for another 2 hours? Well, yes. Yes, they did. If you enjoyed the show, we'd really appreciate it if you could leave a review, subscribe to the show, and tell your friends. Thank you so much to everyone who's done so already. It really does help us to find new listeners who might otherwise miss the show. So until next time, from Dad and me, a very happy new year.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.